So today at Radio Verulam, we're once again speaking to one of your local politicians, and we are speaking to Shadow Home Affairs Minister, Whip and Labour MP, Bambos Charalombos, to get the answers to your questions. Remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get the answer from Bambos this month, he will be back again very soon. Now, Bambos, first of all, we welcome you to Radio Verulam. You're new to us today, and thanks for coming on to the show. But also, September saw you return to Parliament after the summer recess. How has it been returning to the House of Commons?
It's been a bit of a strange experience because whilst many places are under lockdown, Parliament is in a strange hybrid sort of system at the moment. So it's taken a while to adjust to that new system. But it's been busy because we've had lots of important debates. We had the Internal Markets Bill. We've had debates about COVID and a few motions about COVID with restrictions. We've had lots of statements from ministers. We've had all sorts of different debates and discussions. So there's been a fair bit of business going on. But we are very... COVID has been... in the background, every week it's also coming up in some form of debate or other.
This month as well has also been conference month, which has been very busy for you, but also for the electorate. We've gotten used to this, learning about what each party is going to be moving towards over the next year. But you've also got a new leader in Keir Starmer, and he's announced that the party is under new management. What are the main key points that will be different from your previous leader's stance?
Well, I think there's, I think Keir's particularly got the qualities that we need to look for getting ourselves into a position where we win the election next time. So part of that is also about the parliamentary party. So it's good to see all the shadow front bench positions filled, and we've got lots of depth and talent there. But I think being more focused has been very helpful, being more disciplined, having a very professional operation, and show that we can be a very effective opposition. So I think all those things bode well for the future. So I think that people have noticed the difference so far.
And building upon that, you know, you've mentioned the election there. You've lost the last four elections on the trot as a Labour Party. And Keir Starmer himself said, you have to question yourself. You can't question the electorate. So what was wrong with Labour before, and what will the party be doing now to get those votes?
Well, I think clearly when you come to your worst election defeat since 1935, something has to be wrong there. So you need to start off by listening to the electorate. I think, obviously, the people didn't trust to be a government next time. Brexit also an issue. There were questions about leadership. There were a whole series of other things that cropped up just from my experience on the step in Enfield Southgate. But I do think you need to listen to the electorate to understanding why you got. I think that's always the first step to any post-election campaign, to understand why you got to the position that we're in. And you need to build trust and confidence in the electorate. So they need to feel that you're... Not only you listen to them, but you're supporting them. They have trust in you to do things. And it's not just about the parliamentary party. This is about councillors, about all our representatives and nationally. It's about elected mayors, county councillors. So it's everyone in a position of responsibility and accountability. And then show that we're a competent party. And we need to make sure that people do see us as a potential government in waiting. But you need to get the first few steps in place first before people can see that you're competent. And I think that in the 5 months that Keir Starmer's been leader, you've already seen a rise in support in the opinion poll of Labour. So that's a good sign that the next general elections are quite a way away yet. So there's still a lot of work to do. But I think we've started well, and we need to sure build on that progress.
One big progress that possibly the party will be looking into is maybe discussions with the Liberal Democrats. St Albans MP and guest on our show, Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrats, Daisy Cooper, has said this month that under Labour's new leadership, she sees a party she can work with and possibly do a deal with. What do you think has caused this change and shift in the Liberal Democrat position? And is a Labour-Liberal coalition something that the party would entertain?
Break that question down, Elizabeth. I mean, really, when a Labour does well, the Liberals also do well. So sometimes do have a common interest in things. And usually we're on the same side when we divide against government. So we do have commonality of interest on some issues, not on all issues, but on some issues we do have that commonality. We want to make sure that we win any election outright. We need to make sure that our message gets through and that people want to vote Labour in large numbers. After that, then it's a question down to doing the arithmetic. So obviously you can't ever rule out anything, but at this stage we're not looking for any coalition with anybody. But you know, it's not, you don't have to have an hostility towards other parties. You can, and in Parliament, you do have to get on with other people. Personally, I get on very well with Daisy, and we've often been on the same side in argument. But on a national level, that's, way above my period anyway, and we're 4 years away. And you obviously have to look at what the arithmetic was like after any election.
So the possibilities are still open, but as you said there, Bambos, it's something maybe a little bit in the future to kind of consider those sorts of things. But at the moment, in the here and now, we've got lots of community questions for you. And Bambos, we always put this out to the community here because we want to ask what the people want to know. And one of the first ones here, this is a problem that has kind of pestered the Labour Party for a while. But Mike has put a question to us here and he says, I was a long-term Labour Party supporter, but as a Jew, I could not support the party recently due to anti-Semitism. How can you, Bambos, give assurances to British Jews that the Labour Party has rectified these problems?
Well, I think if you look to when Keir Starmer became leader, literally the first words he said after he became leader was that he wanted to stamp out anti-Semitism and apologised to the Jewish community. Anti-Semitism in the party. And that was a watershed moment because, you know, the people in senior positions in the party hadn't said sorry previously. And I think it was time that, you know, that was said. But in order, as I mentioned previously, in order to be confident, you need to show that you're competent. So we need to show we are dealing with complaints of anti-Semitism and taking them seriously. We need to show that we're listening to the Jewish community. Personally, I've had meetings with the Jewish Leadership Council and CST in recent weeks. And obviously, I've got a Jewish community locally in Enfield Southgate who I attend synagogue community events whenever I'm invited. We need to build up those relationships and trust. Jonathan Freeland, the Observer journalist, came with me on a canvas session one Sunday morning in Oakwood during the general election. And anti-Semitism came up time and again on the doorstep. There was one door we knocked on where we had a very irate gentleman who, you know, was literally chasing us down the path with, you know, using his walking stick. So we can't ever allow that to happen. We, you know, the Labour Party has always been on the side of minority communities, always been against racism, and we need to make sure we build up those links again with the community.
So can you give a solid assurance there that at least something is being done eternally now to make sure that this will not arise again?
Well, as I said, the complaints procedure has been put in place, so complaints are being dealt with speedily and effectively. People are being expelled from the party for anti-Semitism now, and hopefully that is showing the Jewish community that we're taking these issues extremely seriously and deal anti-Semitism and they won't be tolerated in the party. I think that's a starting point, but we need to make sure we build up our links with the community and show that we're supportive, and people like the person who you reference can have faith in vote for Labour again.
So moving on to another issue that actually affects Hertfordshire as well as your local constituency, and quite a few individuals have actually contacted us about construction issues, but this one really affects quite a few people, and it's one of the nearest tube stations across the county of Hertfordshire and Enfield as well, Kotfosser Station. The car park there is being taken over with construction of four blocks of up to 14 stories. Only parking for blue badge holders would be retained. Those who can no longer park there will clog up the roads parking, as they will still want to travel in. The demand will still be there. How will local businesses cope? Where will these new residents go to school and also get medical care, as the local services are already overstretched? And resident Andrew has specifically messaged me asking you, Bambos, will you undertake and consider the efficacy of this development?
Yeah, I have a very serious concern about the development. I've gone on record, I've spoken to resident meetings stating my opposition to the scheme. I think there is a problem with the demand in service, so the demand for additional school and medical places. There's also a development that had got planning permission about 4 or 5 years ago, which has yet to be fully implemented. So the pressure on Kotfosser's Road will be, in my opinion, it's bad enough as it is already. If you have two big developments there, it will just add more pressure onto Kotfosser's Road, which even at the best of times is very difficult. So I do think there's a problem with the developments there, and I'll certainly be voicing my opposition to that. There is a bigger issue about the need to have more accommodation, to build more housing in the community, more affordable housing in and around London. So I think that does need to be addressed, but I don't think this one is the appropriate place or development for that. But one thing I will mention, though, is that the government have introduced a number of measures to make planning permission easier to get hold of. We had a debate today in Parliament about the government relaxing the planning rules to make it easy for developers to build, including building two floors above existing buildings with very little oversight. So that's really a cause of concern for the future as well.
You know, for the residents in the area, is there anything that they can actually do? Is there a complaints procedure? And also, this does seem a fairly controversial issue due to the number of messages that we got about this. How has it got through if it is causing this much of a fuss?
Well, it hasn't through because it's still to be determined by the planning committee. So sometime later on this year or early next year, the planning committee will consider the occasion. And I'll be joining the residents who are opposed to this to register my opposition to it, because I do think it's a scheme that's way too big and will cause issues in the area. Even though these schemes are meant to have no parking for residents on the site, I still think people will have cars and they will try and park in the roads, and that will cause further congestion on an already congested road that is there.
But what is the best procedure that a concerned citizen should do then? Should they write to you, or is there a specific petition that maybe they can voice their concern with?
They should write to the council planning department, registering their concern. The concern has to be on planning grounds. And they need to make sure that they're objecting to it purely on the basis of for planning reasons, because that's all that the planning committee will consider. So they need to look at the scale, the size of the development, the impact on local services. Those sorts of things will be the things that the planning committee will consider. There's a whole host of other things. So I encourage people to, if they don't like the scheme, to make sure they register their opposition to it, but make sure the opposition is on for planning reasons.
Moving on to Caroline's question here, and this is another issue that affects people in Hertfordshire and also in your constituency of Southgate, Enfield, Bambos. It's about nursing homes, and it's a difficult issue because, you know, when you get to that stage of your life, you want to be looked after. Now, she has explained that if a person needs residential care, is entirely self-funding, and selects a home that is part private, part state, that person will actually pay far more in fees than the actual cost of their care. This is because the state maximum payment for the residential care is set at a rate too low to cover the cost of care. This means that care homes will calculate its total expenses, deduct the amount received from the state for the residents, then divide the balance between the self-funders. She asks, is this not, in effect, taxation through an alternative route because the self-funders are paying towards the cost of state residents? And adding to that, how is that fair?
I think it's a really fair point that she's made. I think what we need to do is we need to think about the future, and you know, there may come a time we all need a care, and that care would need to be paid for. How that's paid for is the big question that people are grappling with. There's a report that was done, I think it was about 10 years ago. I think it's the Dilnot report from Recognition. That report actually said that there should be, you should pay up to a certain maximum for your care. And that was there for all to see. But we've not had a proper debate and discussion about this because it is a difficult issue to come to grips with. There are different models for care. There is one block in my constituency in Highlands Ridge, which has been bought by people who are homeowners, and they've sold a house and bought a flat in a block where they get some care provided for them, although it's light care, but they actually own the flat that they live in, and they can pass it on to their children, grandchildren, if that time comes. So I think I think there are models which are alternatives to care. Then if people do need serious medical care, so if they need if they've got a condition like Alzheimer's, or if they have a medical condition other than Alzheimer's that needs attention, then that might be a greater cost. But we do need to find a way to do this, because I agree with Caroline's view that it's a very difficult situation. And, you know, we're still waiting for the government to come forward with their plan for social care. It was one of the action pledges that Boris Johnson had his manifesto, that he would deal with, that he have a plan for social care. And we haven't seen that plan yet. So that's something we need to find out.
On top of this, actually, would you say that there's a problem with the ability to get the right funding? Because Caroline has actually opened out and said that the private nursing fees or the NH nursing care, trying to get any funding for this is almost impossible, and it's only pittance when compared to the cost of fees. And actually, you know, the yearly fees is surmounting to about £23,000 for a lot of these elderly individuals who, towards the end of their life, don't really maybe have the ability to defend themselves in these sort of situations there. So is this a problem as well with the actual ability to get funding? And is that something that maybe you could ask for a streamlining almost of the way to get money?
Yeah, well, it certainly should be easy to get a lot of money on the cost of care that provided and the quality. I think for years we've seen, in recent times we've heard of care providers going bust because they can't afford to provide the service at the cost, and that's partly been borne by the cuts in the public sector as well. So I do think we need to have a review as to what are the problems in social care, because you know, Caroline's situation shouldn't arise. Things should happen a lot quicker than they do, and they should get, you know, they should care at a very high level. So, and that's what we need to aspire to. You shouldn't be worried about the care that you receive later on in life and the quality of it. So you should be able to have guaranteed high quality care that is accessible and affordable. And that's what we need to strive towards. But I'm happy to look into Caroline's case in particular. So if you have her details and she's willing for me to pass them on to me, I would happily look at that.
I mean, this is the thing about the Radio Verulam discussions. We like to see democracy in action. So I'm sure I will contact Caroline and then we will hopefully resolve this issue or try and work towards a resolution. Now, another thing that needs resolved in the area, and this is local to you, Bambos, Ricardo has messaged in and he said, why are a lot of the roads in the area being closed? It's causing unnecessary traffic. And the other day, an ambulance actually got stuck because it didn't know the new routes.
The government made some fund available, alternatives to car use, because fear was that during COVID, with the people's fear about using public transport, they would turn to using their cars, which could cause more pollution and more gridlock in certain roads. So they made money available to a number of local authorities, certainly across London. I don't know about wider than London. But some of these schemes have happened really quickly. And the government stipulated you had to implement them within an 8-week period. So they've gone in with very little consultation, and the consultation has been taking place with the schemes being implemented. So, and they are the consultation, so the consultation is happening as the scheme has been put into place. So I'd encourage Ricardo to highlight this issue with the sort of road that he's witnessed the ambulance getting. That really shouldn't happen, and it may be that information hasn't got through to the ambulance service about which roads can't be accessed, but we need to make sure that all our emergency services know exactly where and where they can access roads so they can get there quickly and deal with the problem that they're encountering. But we also need to make sure that people have their say, so people need to be properly consulted, and if the scheme doesn't work, it should be taken out. And so I would encourage Ricardo and other people that are experiencing a scheme isn't working, for them to take part in any consultation that takes place, and to make their views known, and hopefully that will result in changes.
And where exactly can Ricardo find consultation? Is it on a council website, or is there a certain separate website that he's able to send his feedback to?
I think most schemes are being run via councils, so I think it would be in the first instance to the council. But what I've been doing as well is I've been anyone that's contacted me, I've logged their concerns, and I'm doing a very detailed letter to the council as well, so they would have they'll be able to register their complaints via me, and that the letter from me would also count as part of the consultation as well. So so there's no issue about the concern being lost.
So that's a good opportunity there for Ricardo to voice his opinion either to you or to the council directly. Now, Fred has actually asked something personal to yourself here, and I think this is quite informative too. How would you describe your politics? Would it be socialist, left-wing, liberal, Marxist? And he's also added, if not, excluding Starmer, which former leader of the Labour Party or any other world leader would you have most in common with?
I'm not a fan of labels. I mean, personally, I just like, you know, I would love Labour to win an election. So that's where I'm coming from. And anyone who's also willing to help Labour win an election, I'm supportive of them as well. The Even though we had some amazing things in our manifesto last time around, unfortunately, if we're not in power, we're not able to deliver any of those promises. So I think we'll need to be in a position where we can deliver that. I mean, the Labour leader I most admire is Kevin Attlee, because, well, like me, Kevin Attlee was a lawyer, although he was obviously far more senior than me. But he had this incredible knack of getting things done. So when he became Prime Minister, it was when we had the economy was in a poor state. It was after the Second World War. There was lots of issues that needed to resolve. In that time, he built the NHS. He made sure there was a big house build program, so he built lots of council houses. He also introduced the late scheme, and introduced a number of social security measures, were part of the Beveridge report, and many of those things are still with us. So they are. He left a lasting legacy, and also he was actually quite a modest man, not much a talker, but he actually got things done. He allowed the cabinet he had to shine talents. So he was able to, he was able to take a back seat and have people to deliver things, but he was key to actually that being delivered. And I think that he is vastly underrated as a prime minister and a leader, but he would be my preference as a leader.
So, would you say that the legacy of Attlee is what brought you to Labour then, or when you were elected in 2017, but you've been in the party since 2010? Were there other reasons? Because you said you don't like labels, but obviously you are in the Labour Party. What was it that brought you into the Labour fold?
Well, it's obviously representing the community. So I think that when I was growing up, my parents' first language wasn't English. They had difficulty in accessing particular services. So I wanted to be a bridge for not just my parents, but for the wider community to make them aware of services they could access so you could build that quality. So injustice, inequality are both issues that are drivers in me to get things done. So I really cannot stand injustice. I think that that's one of the key drivers for me to overcome injustice.
So, moving it on to Danny's question here, and he says, could you ask Bambos, could he name one of the Tory policies that he actually think has been good?
Well, that's put me on the spot a bit. I mean, I think the, I mean, some of the, we had an announcement this week about the government investing more in renewable energy, about the more wind-powered energy. And, of course, very much welcome. I do think we need to do far more in investing in renewables and make sure we reach net zero as soon as possible, because, the tipping point for climate change is fast approaching. So I do think anything to do with the environment that is green is a very good idea. So things like that I would certainly welcome. But I do have there aren't very many other policies I would agree with.
Do you think there is a problem though in politics that there's maybe too much partisanism and not enough trying to come to agreements on this? Because obviously I asked you the question there and you did have a wry smile on your face because it was putting you on the point a little bit. But is there sometimes too much dedication to party than actually seeing through? And I'm not just saying for Labour, but this is a Liberal and Conservative problem as well, that they can't put party politics aside and actually decide when something is for the good of the people of the country.
I think that's a bit unfair. I think if you look at Parliament, the actual, there are many bills that pass without vote, that things that we would are controversial that need to be done, that we agree with, but we may think they need to be done a bit better. So I think that's I think there are things that do pass without necessarily a vote that we do broadly support. But you have to take each bill, each measure as you find it. There are some things we would be very much against. But there is when you become an MP, there is a series of wanting to do things and have a. You do have to do that with a certain degree of cooperation. That's not. We're never always opposed to every bit of legislation, but there are some key things that we do have big dividing lines on. There are times when we think a bill can be made better, and we do table amendments, and ultimately we hope the government take them on board, and we hope that they will make the bill better than it is. But I do think we can to make things better, and it isn't always blue is good, red is bad, or vice versa. So I think I think we do need to look at what's presented to us and make a decision on a case-by-case basis.
Moving on to your own party then here, and Rob has actually asked a question as your role as the whip. He said, as a whip, has there been any MP, former or current, who was particularly difficult to make vote with the party line?
Well, there were certainly a few from the last parliament who had particular views on Brexit. And some of them were easier to deal with than others. Like some of them you just accepted they were just going to break with, they weren't going to stand again for re-election. So there was very little you could do them because they just had that particular viewpoint. But as a whip, you have to be very sensitive to people's views. You have to understand why they're voting for a particular view if it's contrary to what the whip is. As a whip, you have a pastoral role, so you have to tend to the needs and concerns of your flock. That's what they call the number of MPs that you're responsible for. And you have to listen to them. And ultimately, if there is a big problem with a particular vote, then you feed that up to the chief. And there have been occasions when, because of disquiet about a particular vote, that the whip has changed during the day. So sometimes you're there to feedback information and listen to your flock's views, and then on that basis see what you can do to help them.
It's an interesting perspective into the whip's life there. And do you feel that it's actually quite stressful for you sometimes? Do you feel, quite a heavy load, a burden to kind of keep the party's line in check?
Not necessarily, although you obviously have to work hard as a whip because you have to communicate with the MPs in your flock, and you have to make sure that they're aware as to which votes are coming and when they're coming, and to be on the premises at a particular time to vote. Although it's with proxy voting, that isn't as problematic. But it does take up a bit more time than normal. You have to spend at least an hour a day on the front bench doing your bench duty, liaising with the speaker or the deputy speakers in the front bench, and making sure people are in the chamber to take part in debates. When you win a vote, it can be incredibly rewarding. We won a number of votes in the last parliament against the government. When you win by four or five, it's you've done your work and people have come in and voted, then it's a great feeling. But unfortunately, I think it's less likely we'll have so many wins in this parliament. But you're there to help get the party's position through and do that to your best of your abilities. But you also to listen to your flock's concerns and try to help them if they need help.
Have you ever had the position where it's been hard for you personally to toe the party line because you actually disagree with an issue? Has this not come up for you?
I mean, it hasn't really come up that often. I didn't think having the general election was a good idea, but we were whipped to vote for a general election. So reluctantly, I voted for the general election last time round. But even though we'd whipped people to vote against general election just a few days earlier, we were now saying to them, actually, we're voting for one now. So it was quite a hard position to have, but that's where we were. And part of it was because the other parties had decided that they wanted to have a general election, so we're going to end up having one. So sometimes there's a futility in trying to keep a particular position times like that. But more often than not, it's I've had no problem at all with taking decisions, voting with the whip. And if I had a problem, then I would certainly speak to the chief about it.
Excellent. And again, it's a fascinating insight into the life of an MP with such a position as yours in Parliament. But Tina, I think, is ending our discussions today with maybe a really positive note here. And she's asked you, what is your proudest achievement, or maybe achievement, you might not be able to pick one, during your career as an MP?
I think as an MP, you want to affect change. So one of the things that I was able to do, and there's a story to this, when I was campaigning to get elected in 2017, the local Autistic Society had a hustings meeting in a local coffee shop. And after the hustings, they said, if you get elected, will you promise to meet with our national organisation and help, debate autism? So I got elected, I kept my promise, I met with the National Autistic Society, and I asked them, what's the one thing I can do to help you? And they said, if you had a debate about autism and about the time it takes from referral to diagnosis, because there weren't any stats on that, and it was taking years in some places for that to happen. So I put in for a debate, to my amazement, I got a listen to the debate for an hour and a half. And I wasn't expecting anything from government, but the government, I asked the government to start recording the time it takes from referral diagnosis. And to my amazement, the government gave a concession. So and they said, we will from now on start recording the time it takes from when a child heard to be assessed to being diagnosed, and we'll monitor that so we can improve the standards. So that was a big event for me, because it would make a difference to the lives of many young people with undiagnosed autism. So that's a small thing, but it's something that I think was very important that I was able to achieve. And I was very grateful to the minister for agreeing to do that.
And living up to what you...
So powers of persuasion.
Living up to what you said was one of the reasons why you got involved with politics, to make change for people. And I suppose one last question for me as well was it possibly one of your proudest achievements getting elected, overturning David Burrows? Because he'd been in Southgate for 12 years as an MP since 2005. So was that in of itself to defeat the Conservative Party there, bring Labour back to Southgate, in of itself a huge achievement?
I had a wonderful team that worked incredibly hard to help get me elected, so it was a team effort, I was very proud to win, it was quite unexpected for many people, but I think that things were changing. I mean, Brexit was a big issue as well, so I was very much a Remainer. David Burrows was a Brexiteer, the seat was a Remain seat. So I think there were factors that did work in our favour. It's a huge privilege and an honour to be the Member of Parliament for Brent Southgate, and I will do my best to retain the seat work hard for the people that put me there.
And how did you keep the strength? Because you tried in 2010 and 2015 to get elected. How did you keep your belief up during that period that you would overcome and get elected during that time?
I think with the in 2015, we did better than people expected because we reduced the Conservative majority. So I think that gave me hope for the future. And we made gains in council elections in seats that we hadn't previously held for. So I think that coupled with the Brexit vote, and also the mass membership of the Labour Party, and the enthusiasm of the election. I think that all. I think you have to keep believing, and you have to. What's the phrase? Success is when opportunity meets preparation. So I think that. I think just being ready and being and knowing what we got wrong previously, and. Just thinking, well, I'm going to give it another go and see what happens. Just having that faith in your own abilities, having an amazing team supporting you is what kept me going. So, and the desire to serve in unity.
Well, it's a useful quote there and maybe serves to some people listening today to keep going themselves, especially during these very difficult times indeed. But for today, I do have to thank you for your time, Bambos. And for those of you who didn't have their question answered this time around, Bambos will be returning next month. So make sure to get your questions in to jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com. But thank you very much for your time today, Bambos.
Thank you.